Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for March 2nd, 2009, and on this week's episode, we have an interview with Marilyn Campbell and Christina Calvet. They're interviewed by Ann Nicholson Weber. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, and let's talk theater.
This is Ann Nicholson Weber, and you're listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. My guests today are Marilyn Campbell and Christina Calvet, both of whom are adapters, both of whom have had experience taking novels and reimagining them for the stage. Christina's adaptation of Mariette in Ecstasy is currently playing, just opened at Lifeline Theater. And Marilyn's adaptation of Crime and Punishment was developed at Writers Theater and is now making its way out into the broader world. Each of them have had significant other experiences with the process of adaptation, so that's what we're going to talk about today. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Maybe we could start, Marilyn, if you would just tell me how you would begin looking at Crime and Punishment on the desk in front of you and say, okay, now I'm going to turn that into a play. What do you do?
Well, in my case, I was commissioned by Michael Halberstam at the Writers Theater, who asked me to, was very interested in the novel, asked me to, if I could adapt the novel, which is not really something I would have chosen for myself, really. But when opportunity knocks, you, in this business anyway, yes is the first answer, always. So he gave me a set of parameters, and the parameters were he wanted to concentrate the novel on the story between the detective and murder aspect of the story. Mm-hmm. And he really wanted me to create a play between the two men, Raskolnikov and the detective Porfiry Petrovich. So I took the novel, started to get into it, and quickly realized that we had to have the female voice as well. So mm-hmm. we added Sonia in. She's the redemptive sort of heart, I felt, of the novel. So that was really a major, one of my major contributions was putting her back in. So to answer your question, as I cut the book up, I really tried to lift that particular part of the story out of the novel and concentrate just on that telling and, mm-hmm. and get rid of everybody else.
So mechanically, it sounds like you're just essentially taking a paperback copy of the book and,
extracting
and pulling out
what you
text
yeah,
and then starting
right.
to push it around
that's
and figure
correct.
Out what you can keep.
Yes.
Well, Christina, your adaptation of Mariette in Ecstasy is different in that it's, first of all, a novel by a living writer and a somewhat smaller book.
And not substantially sort of smaller, a quarter of the size of Crime
right.
and Punishment.
Right. But what is your answer? Is it different? I mean, it sounds like you wouldn't have had the parameters, maybe.
I mean, I read the book when it first came out, which I believe was in the early 90s, and the text moved me mm-hmm. incredibly. Ron Hanson is an amazing writer, amazing women characters. And from the very beginning, myself and then Meryl Friedman, who was the managing director of Lifeline Theater at the time, both thought that this was a book that should be on stage. Mm-hmm. And we talked about it for a long time. Then we were a little less sophisticated, a little less established. We were nervous about how we would sell it. And we just kind of put it on the shelf.
Why were you nervous about how you would sell it?
We felt at that time, I mean, since that time, I think it's become a better known book in terms mm-hmm. of it. It was a big book club book, I mm-hmm. think. And then Ron Hanson, of course, has written more and become more prominent, but back then we were just a little nervous about the selling power of the title, to mm-hmm. be quite honest, because mm-hmm. we were having great success with big titles like Pride and Prejudice and Jane Eyre and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, all of these, you know, things that make people sit up and go, oh, mm-hmm. yeah, I want to see that.
Right.
That's a book I know and love. So we weren't sure if that would be the case with Mariette. So we put it on the shelf. I kept rereading the book. I think I reread it maybe two or three times mm-hmm. in the intervening years, and this year just seemed right. I brought it to the ensemble. Elise Kozlarik, who directed it, was taken by it, very much taken by it, and so together we kind of powerhoused it through.
Well, what you said, this was a book you felt would make a good stage mm-hmm. play. What are the qualities of a novel that get your antennae, you know?
I think first and foremost, great dialogue for mm-hmm. me, mm-hmm. I think, because that's kind of the basis of what you work with as an adapter. So that's, or that many adapters work with that. You know, some will take narration and blow it out and it'll become this big poetic, beautiful whatever mm-hmm. on stage. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's always the dialogue that draws me. And I work actually in a similar way usually to how Marilyn works. When I'm working with bigger texts especially, I like take those big pieces of dialogue that I love and those go in my computer first. And then I think, how can I link these and what are the themes and blah, blah, blah.
That's exactly what we did. Yeah. And really, as we boiled the book down, we realized that the main essence of the story was captured in the three interrogation scenes between Porfiry and the three confession scenes with Sonia. And that's where all the dialogue is, that's mm-hmm. where the conversations are, that's where the philosophy really comes out. And so really the play, when you look at it, are those six scenes and then some connective material, the murder and so forth, but that's where the dialogue was yeah. and that's where you go.
I think dialogue is often the inspiration.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the easy answer is a book that has a lot of good dialogue is a likely candidate
right.
for a stage
and not
play.
Just good dialogue necessarily, like lively dialogue, but dialogue that has a lot of subtext. For me, in this book, mm-hmm. they say a lot of words, but what they mean or what you could interpret is so wild.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was a big attractor for me in this book particularly, is that what they were saying and what they were meaning was not the same thing. And so it was just so fascinating.
That's interesting. So you lose, obviously, a great deal when you boil a book down. Notably, I would think, point of view, you lose narration, you lose description, all of which can be the heart of the novel or an important tools in how a novelist says what he or she has to say. Are there substitutes for any of those that you can put on the stage? Is there something that you do because there was this wonderful narrative passage or there was this amazing description? Do those find a life on the stage somehow?
I think the cloister life, as he describes, as Ron Hanson describes in Mariette in Ecstasy, is so interesting and rich. And we did try to translate, and hopefully we're successful at translating, that sense of silence, the work, the repetition, and the holiness of
the book. Why don't you describe those little vignettes
yeah.
that you used?
Elise's idea was to, we create passage of time in these segments that we call the work segments, where we see the nuns in stylized, amplified space doing simple jobs. So they're sweeping rhythmically, they're plastering rhythmically, they're scrubbing floors. And I'm not doing a really good job of telling how beautiful it is, but with the light and with the sound and their movement, I think it helps create this sense of cloister life.
Well, it's a kind of percussion music. I mean,
yeah,
it creates
yeah.
a music.
It creates
using those sounds coming all together in a very rhythmic way.
And yeah, and hopefully helps you understand the rhythm of their mm-hmm. lives, because their lives are very regimented and very rhythmic. But there's a beauty to that as well as a confinement.
And then another element that was in the play, and I haven't yet read the novel, was the singing of the nuns.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that Ron Hanson talked about, or did you pull that in because you were...
Yeah, that was pulled in. Again, a brilliant idea from Elise. Mm-hmm. I had nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
But she wanted a cappella, choral, religious music to be a part of the show. And it isn't really implicit in the book. I mean, they... In true cloister life, they pray the hours, so they are singing constantly in prayer. But the book, while it goes into that's not a major part of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And they may mention it once or twice. But part of what we wanted to create, and Elise, I think, wanted to create with that conceit, was to be able to give you a sense of the spiritual space, the church space, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Ron Hanson does a brilliant job in the book of describing the church and the beauty of the church and how you feel when you walk into the oratory or the major chapels or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't do that. I mean, our space is so small and we can't create those spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So she did that through music.
Mm-hmm. Well, Marilyn, doing Crime and Punishment, do you have Any other answers to those questions about...
Well, one of the things I was going to say was we were lucky with Crime and Punishment because so much of it is narrated by the murderer. So a lot of, some of it, some of the narration we were able to turn into speeches, like you said, which were great.
You would have the choice to actually have narration.
We did. And, you know, in the original adaptation, when I presented my final adaptation after several workshops, it was about 2 hours and 45 minutes long, and it had about 7 characters in it. It had the 3 main characters, which was the assignment, and I just couldn't quite figure out how to tell the rest of the story without other characters. So I had an older man and an older woman and a younger man and a younger woman that sort of picked up the rest of the characters. And then I had put it in a linear fashion. So we kept trying to eliminate the narration and trying very hard to make this leap, and we were having difficulties. So we knew that Kurt, you know, spoke Russian. So we asked Kurt if he would come in. It was also one of his novels that he adored more than anything in the world. So when Kurt came in and looked at it, it was there, but what he figured out how to do was to take it out of time. He took the novel out of time and put it in Raskolnikov's head. So it's almost like a fever dream, which is perfect, you know, for the stage. And Kurt said in an interview that we did recently out in Cleveland that when an audience comes to see a novel, they don't, don't present them the novel. You can go home and read the novel. You know, the thing is, and this is the most difficult thing, is to reimagine it for the theater. And by honing it down to those 3 people, by putting it all into those 3 people, and it intensified, you know, the whole experience and really took that leap. So
Well, with Mariette, I was the structure, which involves some sort of flash forward, flash back, going back and forth between 2 times. Is that in the novel, or is that something that you developed for the stage?
No, it is in the novel. It's wonderful because, you know, the novel itself is very contemplative and kind of quiet, and it's this big old character study, especially at the beginning. But what Ron Hansen did by inserting those passages has made you go, whoa, something happened. I got to know what happened. There's a mystery here, so that it just pulls you through. You know, I read it in one sitting when I read it, because I had to know what was going on.
Right. Well, and both books actually are mysteries, essentially.
Mysteries and spiritual. We sit down in our story and read the story of Lazarus right out of the Bible. It takes about 3 to 5 minutes. But the image of this murderer and this prostitute reading, it makes me cry every time I say it out loud. It's just so moving. It's so sweet. It's so human that these 2 broken, fallen people are coming together and trying to heal themselves and, you know, lift themselves up. It's very spiritual. Some people have a hard time with that. It's very Russian and very Dostoevsky to include that Christian bent.
They get their redemption. I mean, that's the great message, is no matter who you are, you can you can redeem yourself.
Well, do you want to talk, Christina, about the spirituality of Mariette?
Well, it's a story. It's a story of a young woman, in her late teens, actually, who goes to a priory to become a postulant, which is the first step that you take in taking your vows to become a nun. And she goes there because she has had experiences in her life thus far where she's experienced Jesus, God, in a very passionate, visceral way. She goes there hoping to experience Jesus more strongly even than she has in her regular life. And she doesn't. And so her spiritual journey is about going as a passionate seeker, almost a teenager in love. It feels like that's the connection that she has with God. And she goes there, and it's as if your big old crush rejected you. And now you are bereft and weeping, and as teenagers do. I mean, they're taking it, you know, you take it very, very hard when you're young, and love is rejected. And then she has a spiritual experience that basically splits the priory. Mm-hmm. The nuns and the novices that are there already each have an opinion about this spiritual experience. Some of them believe that it happened. Some of them don't. They all know that she's different and attractive and almost a celebrity amongst them. And so the rest of the book is about what happens to this community mm-hmm. when such an attractive, vibrant, and strange, really, person enters it.
It's interesting because I'm thinking as you're talking that two of the qualities of the stage that are, I won't say unique maybe, but strong aspects of what makes theater theater are a sense of the sacred space and community. And so I'm wondering if, you know, somehow that's a good reason to put this play on stage.
You know, I never thought about that, but it's true. It's true. I mean, that's why I was drawn to the book. I happen to be Episcopalian, but I feel that most people are searching for the sacred, some not the sacred exactly, but some sort of elevation beyond the real world mm-hmm. in their lives. And this is the reason that they go to see any kind of artistic work, whether right. it be you know, at the theater or movies or whatever.
Well,
you know?
Well,
maybe
movies.
Not. Maybe less.
I mean, some movies.
Some and some theater works too, as
right.
well. You know, it isn't right. always. Sometimes, mm-hmm. I guess, for sure, it's just entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I think. I mean, and that's why. Again, another reason besides just the great dialogue to translate a book to the stage is that you get to give people a more intimate and visceral experience of what the essence of that book is. So for me, that ability to be able to show a woman coming out of herself and really communing with something that she thought was so important and so big and so loving, an object of love, was just... You know, I wanted to share that experience mm-hmm. with people.
Well, I guess you do have to. I mean, maybe you don't, but I ask the question, why adapt an existing novel instead of putting on an original play? I mean, I know this is very much at the core of what Lifeline does,
mm-hmm.
But it seems to me like a fair question. We've got all kinds of playwrights writing all kinds of work that
right,
never sees
right.
the light of day. Ron Hansen's book is available at least as a novel. Do you have an answer to that question?
Marilyn, do you want to talk first?
I just think there's room in the theater for everything, and there's an interest in putting great books on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
There just is.
Mm-hmm.
People, with Crime and Punishment, for example, people are like, oh, thank you, it's only 80 minutes long. Don't have
Cliff
to
notes.
Read the novel. You know, that's a part of it. When you're writing in the theater, you know, the theater is, you know, I just went to see Ann Filmer's theater last night, and her theater is all about, you know, change, and someone in the audience asked, is theater only about, you know, political movement? You know, no, that's her kind
theater.
Of bent to it.
Mm-hmm.
But, and for me, as for some people, it's visual. For me, it's literary.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hear literature in the mm-hmm. theater. And I think that's why a lot of people, you know, go. And the show's playing at Cleveland right now, and they're doing an adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird there. Mm-hmm. All across the country, people are doing them. And as I said, I just think it's valuable to have it as part of the canon.
Yeah, I think there's a longing out there, certainly for some books. You know, maybe not so much for Married in Ecstasy, but books like Jane Eyre and Pride and Prejudice. I mean, people just... They love those stories, and they love those stories, seeing those stories in a more immediate way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a part of my attraction, is I just think, you know, lots of times in a big book, you're looking at a lot of themes, you're looking at a lot of ways that you can go. A book is about so many things. Mm-hmm. And I think as an adapter, I, you know, look at it and I say, okay, to me, this book is about this one thing. And I'm going to do everything that I can to bring that passionately alive to people so that they, it's a selfish thing, I guess, so that they can experience it the way I've experienced
mm-hmm.
it. I want to translate that for them. You know, a translator can use all different words and all different phrases to say the same original thing. But so I want to channel that
mm-hmm.
for them so they can.
Let me ask you about Mariette. What were some of the real challenges? Where did you get stuck? What things did you struggle with?
Well, it's weird because normally I'm doing like what Marilyn does. I'm taking a giant book and kind of honing it down. And this is a tiny book, you know, compared to these other big texts.
Mm-hmm.
So. So it really wasn't a situation of cutting and cutting and cutting. It was more the book has 30 or 40 nuns in it. So in order, and the writing is very pastiche-like. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. You'll love it when you read it. It's just a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of this scene. And so all the scenes are tiny. Mm-hmm. And the nuns are all over it. You know, you have to go keep referring back to the front of the book so you can figure out which nun
Who's
is
who.
Which.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what I had to do was I had to look at it. I said, given the theme that I want to explore, what are the archetypes that I'd like to take us through this journey? Mm-hmm. And so combine those 30 nuns down to, you know, 10, essentially, mm-hmm. and make sure that their journeys were very clear. Mm-hmm. So that was the big thing.
Mm-hmm. So I imagine doing Crime and Punishment, the answer would be very different.
I talked
about it a little bit, but... Well, you talked about how you got stuck on, you know, it was just too huge and too many characters.
Well, there was this enormous character named Svidrigaïlov who's essential to the story. He was the hardest character to lose. Mm-hmm. And then I lost his best friend. And, you know, yes, you see them sort of falling out.
On the cutting room floor, all
sad.
Your darlings
they
on
are,
the cutting room
they
floor.
Are sad.
Right, right, right. Well, what is Ron Hansen's involvement or awareness, or I mean, you just buy the rights and do whatever you want. Do you have to worry
about
what
different,
he thinks of it?
It's different with different authors, but Ron was so cool. He is totally hands off. He, you know, basically said, "You guys do what you do." Mm-hmm. And so he was. I was nervous though. I mean, once I did something that was a living author, Angus Thong's in Full Frontal Snogging, but Louise Renison lives in. In the UK, so she wasn't going to come see it. So
right.
This is actually the first piece I've ever had that.
The author come and see
it.
And you said
he
came to a second preview.
He came to a second preview.
You weren't quite ready.
Well, yeah, you know, because our preview process is long. We have 2 weekends of previews, mm-hmm. and we change quite a bit in between. And so we didn't want him to see it until it was absolutely perfect. But it was wonderful, and he, I think he really enjoyed it, and he... talked to all the actors and made them feel great, and so bless him.
Good. Good. I'm actually interested in the question of rights. Do you buy the entire dramatic right, so to speak? In other words, can someone else not adapt it now?
Yes, that's true. If you're going to do a play like Anne Sexton, mm-hmm. We had to deal with her estate, and it was a very touchy estate, as you can imagine, her being a suicidal poet. So we had to go through a whole process with them, and they do own a third of our play every time it's put on.
Mm-hmm.
But it's different with every single, you know, sometimes you're dealing with an estate. I'm working on a Mae West piece right now. Got to their estate, and they gave me complete carte blanche. Use anything you want. Use novels, use poems, use lyrics to songs. I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get into where I was with Allen Ginsberg. You know, and there's sometimes when you deal with the authors firsthand, it's a lot easier
than
you're dealing with
with
an estate, because
mm-hmm.
they're trying to get a lot of money. When I did The Beats, Francis Ford Coppola owned all the rights to Jack Kerouac's material.
Really? Interesting.
Bought it all. I didn't know that. So I, you know, followed the train and finally got to his office.
Mm-hmm.
And his answer was, do whatever you want with the material. We want it out there. We want people to hear it.
Right.
Go. They didn't charge me any money.
Wow.
A couple of my beatnik poets, Diane De Prima, you know, they charged me a very nominal fee.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost better, as
because
I said.
The artists want the work to get
they
out there
sure
every way.
Do.
And,
yes,
and
yes,
I do
indeed,
imagine
do.
That Ron mm-hmm. Hansen will see, at least in the Chicago area, a little blip in sales because
I hope so.
People get interested as a result of seeing it.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's different for every author and... because we do only adaptations, we're constantly trying to get rights to things. And oftentimes the authors will be like, yes, I'd love to have you do my book. And then we run up into,
mm-hmm.
sold the movie rights.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's gone
mm-hmm.
in the United States. The UK, it's a little easier.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to keep their theatrical and movie rights separate. But boy, once the movie rights go... you can't get a stage,
and
at least in my experience. Maybe yours has been different.
Not yet.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't gone that red, but I wanted to talk to you about the idea of exclusivity. Because when you For a show like Anne Sexton, where we were producing it off-Broadway, we did ask for exclusivity. But a lot of times, you just ask for performance permission, mm-hmm. and if they know you're not going to make a ton of money on it, they'll let you go ahead and do it, mm-hmm. and won't even, you know, won't even make you sign anything. They'll give you permission or give you a... So it really just depends on the author and the estate, but if you're going to do... You know, like if this Mae West thing took off and I did it on Broadway, I would have to ask for exclusivity for the material that I was using in that.
So someone couldn't do something similar.
That's correct.
That wasn't. Is there something, do you think, that is characteristic of people who like doing adaptations as compared to writing original work, for instance? Is there something that you two might find at your core artistically?
I'm not as creative, so I can't write.
You borrow stories, right?
For me, I was an actor, and it was really a way for me to create work for myself. Mm-hmm. The Anne Sexton piece I produced off-Broadway and starred in with a couple other people, but we put it together to showcase ourselves and our own work. And many, many times, that's the reason why I've gone ahead and been searching for something to perform for myself.
Christina, how did you begin? What was your first adaptation, and how did it come about?
It was Pride and Prejudice. We did it in 86. I went into it quite blindly. I mean,
you were a member of the company at that point?
I wasn't, actually, but Lifeline had been started by a group of Northwestern students, and as you know, the performance studies department there is very strong. We had all been exposed to adaptations in school, you know, back mm-hmm. in the 70s. Mm-hmm. So it was not new territory for me or unfamiliar territory, but I had never done anything like that before, never done that giant of a book. The most I'd ever done was short stories.
Yeah.
So I went into it kind of blindly, and we had good success with it. You know, in those days, the theater was producing a lot of new English plays, scrabbling always to get rights. This was something that you didn't have to worry about rights because it was in the public domain, and people came mm-hmm. because they wanted to see that story.
Well, and that adaptation then went on to Stratford in Ontario, right?
Right.
Yeah, so that was great.
Just another thing, too, about Chicago and Northwestern. Yeah. This is Chicago is a town that has a rich, rich history of adaptations, and I bet you we put out more here than any place else mm-hmm. in the country. Mm-hmm. I bet, because...
That's interesting. Well, I wonder if in an age where we're worrying about literacy, certainly there's a benefit. I guess I also cynically think people, it's very hard to sell an unknown new play. It's a lot easier to sell a play. Just what you were saying about Mariette in the old days when you were worried about putting it on because it's not a familiar title. It seems like the theater is struggling to find brand names.
Yes, it's helpful at the box office.
Right.
And Crime and Punishment is selling in a big way because it's only three actors. I'm
right.
sure, you know, it's
right.
very economical right now to do. You get a lot of bang for your buck mm-hmm. Out of the piece.
I was thinking, seeing the show last night, that Mariette has 10 actors, is that right?
12.
12 actors. Not something you could probably do in an Equity House
mm-mm.
right now.
No, we don't think about the life really beyond. I mean, I've gotten some queries about it, mm-hmm. but yeah, I can't imagine it's wildly commercial.
Well, it's a really effective play, though, I have to say.
Oh,
I thought
I'm
it was clear that I was not alone in being very drawn.
Yeah, don't put yourself down in that. I think you'd be surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's not something we think about.
What you want to do.
Yeah, the work is for here, and so if it has a life beyond, that's great, and then if it doesn't,
serendipity,
it doesn't.
Right. Well, thank you both so much for talking about
thank
this.
You.
I appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of March 2nd, 2009. Profiles Theater continues its 20th anniversary season with the new dark comedy, The Wonderful World of Dissocia, by Anthony Nielsen. The production runs March 26th through May 10th at the Profiles Theater. The Wonderful World of Dissocia is a colorful and exciting off-kilter trip that follows Lisa Jones in a search for the one lost hour that has tipped the balance of her life. The inhabitants of the world are funny, friendly, and brutal. The show is an original play, both magical and moving, and it confirmed Anthony Neilson as one of the major voices in contemporary British theater. The Wonderful World of Dissocia received its lauded world premiere at the Edinburgh International Festival and went on to win every major category at the Critics Awards for Theatre in Scotland, including Best New Play and Best Production. This is the fourth production of the Profiles' 20th anniversary season, following their acclaimed productions of Great Falls by Lee Blessing, The Thugs by Adam Bach, and Men of Tortuga by Jason Wells. The final production of the season will be the world premiere of Graceland by Ellen Ferry. Tickets for The Wonderful World of Dissocia are currently available online. For more information and the links to get those tickets, click on over to theaterinchicago.com. Broadway in Chicago will present the Chicago debut of Legally Blonde, the musical, for a four-week engagement from May 12th through June 7th at the Ford Center for the Performing Arts, also known as the Oriental Theater. Individual tickets will go on sale Friday, March 6th at 10 a.m. Sorority star Elle Woods doesn't take no for an answer, so when her boyfriend dumps her for someone more serious, Elle puts down the credit cards and hits the books and sets out to go where no Delta Nu has gone before, Harvard Law School. Along the way, Elle proves that being true to yourself never goes out of style. In the first year on Broadway, Legally Blonde the musical earned 7 Tony Award nominations, 10 Drama Desk Award nominations, an Outer Critics Circle Award, and the musical also ranked in the top 10 list of the most requested Ticketmaster arts and theater events for 2007. As mentioned earlier, individual tickets will go on sale Friday, March 6th. A select number of premium seats are available for select performances. Head on over to our website for more information. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago, and I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Marilyn Campbell and Christina Calvet for giving us the honor of interviewing them this week. I would also like to thank Ann Nicholson Weber and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we will be here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.